treasure,
said Little Richard.
The treasure ain't heavy, said Slank, and it floated, don't forget.
But if it's not the treasure?
Wreckage from the Neverland, I'd venture to guess. I don't know why they'd be dragging it up the beach.
He looked up toward the jungle, and Little Richard followed his gaze.
Be going in there? He asked.
A big ape like you, afraid? Said Slank.
Spiders, said Little Richard sheepishly. I hates them.
I reckon there's spiders in there, big as your fist, teased Slank. Hairy spiders. Spiders that need a shave.
Little Richard shuddered, then saw something in the sand.
Look here, he said.
Slank came over to see what Little Richard was pointing to. It was an indentation in the moist sand, with parallel bands running left to right. Between the bands was a pattern of wood grain.
Water barrel, Slank said.
Whoever was dragging it stopped to rest here. Mr. Blackstash might be a fearsome pirate, but he's not much of a tracker, is he? He's chasing a water barrel.
Slank barked out a laugh.
What's more, he continued, the fool's left his longboat unguarded. We'll tow it around that point.
He indicated a curving spit of sand in the distance.
So when Mr. Stash returns from his water barrel chase, he'll find he has a nasty long swim to reach the wasp. Meanwhile, we'll be locating that treasure.
How do you know it's here?
Said Little Richard.
How do you know the storm didn't carry it off?
Oh, it's here all right, said Slank,
his hand going to the chain at his neck.
I can feel it. It's here, and it's going to be mine.
Chapter 43 Visitors.
Alf gaped at the savage for several seconds before he could get the words out.
You speak English? He said.
Yes,
said the savage.
So apparently do you.
The savage grunt-clicked something to the others who chuckled.
But how? Said Alf.
Oh, English is easy, said the savage. You want a difficult language? Try this one.
He rattled off a bizarre-sounding sequence of grunts, clicks and pops, culminating in a low whistle. This got another big laugh.
Yes, said Alf, but what I mean is, how did you learn English?
The same way you did, I assume, said the savage, from listening to Englishmen. I spent 13 years on ships of the British Navy.
You was a sailor? Said Alf.
I think a more accurate word is slave, said the savage, although the term the Navy used was pressed into service. 20 years ago they landed here and took me, and my two brothers.
The savage's tone remained conversational, but his eyes had turned cold.
My brothers responded to captivity less well than I, he continued. They were both gone within a year, but I was adaptable and quite good at languages. 13 years I spent in the company of doing the bidding of Englishmen. 13 years until the kindness of fate and a shipwreck brought me back home to Mollusk.
Mollusk?
Said Alf. The name we call this island, our home, said the savage. Actually, our word for it is.
He uttered a strange sound from somewhere deep in his throat.
We call ourselves the Mollusk people. I have the honor of being our leader. My name, or the English version of my name, is Fighting Prawn.
Fighting Prawn? Said Alf.
Does my name amuse you, Englishman? Said Fighting Prawn.
No,
said Alf, his grin evaporating.
If I may ask, said Fighting Prawn, what is your name?
Alf, said Alf.
Alf,
repeated Fighting Prawn. He said something to the other mollusks, which included Alf. They roared with laughter. Fighting Prawn turned back to Alf.
In our language, he said, Alf means squid poop.
Oh,
said Alf. Now, Alf, said Fighting Prawn, getting a chuckle from the men,
these boys, he gestured to James, Prentice, Thomas and Tubby Ted, are they your children?
Oh, no, said Alf, them's orphans, from the ship.
I see, said Fighting Prawn, and where is your ship at present?
Bottom of the sea, I reckon, said Alf. Storm broke her to pieces, it did. We barely got off with our skins.
Pity, said Fighting Prawn. And were there any other survivors?
Dunno, said Alf, shaking his head. It was terrible rough out there. A bloody miracle we found this island, it is.
Oh, you'd be surprised, said Fighting Prawn. We get visitors here every year or so. Some arrive through misfortune, as in your case, others arrive with a purpose. At one time the mollusks welcomed these visitors. We have learnt better.
What do you mean? Said Alf.
I mean, said Fighting Prawn, that we have learnt that things seem to work best on mollusks when the only inhabitants are mollusks.
There were a few moments of silence, broken by James.
Sir, if you please,
he said.
Yes, boy, said Fighting Prawn.
What happened to the others, the visitors? Do they still live here?
Fighting Prawn regarded James for a moment, his black eyes impassive.
No, he said finally. They no longer live here.
So, said James, when visitors come, you let them go?
I didn't say that, said Fighting Prawn.
Chapter 44, Parting Ways. Peter stopped, holding up his hand. Molly paused a foot behind him. They'd moved along the edge of the clearing, following the sound of voices. Mostly they'd heard two, Alf and another man, both speaking English, which puzzled Peter as the only men he'd seen, other than Alf, were savages. Now, approaching the voices, separated from the clearing by only a few yards of thick vegetation, Peter turned and leaned in close to Molly, speaking in the barest whisper.
How much of that stuff have you got left in your locket? I don't know, she whispered back. Why, what are you thinking?
I'm going to run out there and start yelling, said Peter. I'll get the savages to chase me into the jungle. Then you can run over to the boys and Alf and fly them out of there. We can meet on the beach.
Molly shook her head.
No, Peter, she said. I don't know if I've got enough star stuff left for that. Besides, they would likely catch us both before we took two steps.
Then what's your plan? Said Peter.
We go find the trunk first, said Molly. With more star stuff.
No,
Peter interrupted.
They could be dead by then. We don't know where the trunk is. We don't even know if it's on this island.
Molly reached up, wrapped a hand around her locket and said,
It's not far off. I can feel it. We must find it. It's our only hope to help the boys.
You don't care about my mates, Peter said. You just want your trunk.
That's not true, she said. Of course I care about them. But yes, the trunk is more important than any of us. Than all of us combined, and right now it's also our only hope to help the boys and ourselves. Please, Peter.
Peter shook his head.
I won't leave my mates, he said. I can't.
All right, said Molly. Fine, then. I'll find the trunk on my own.
Seriously? You won't help me?
Help you get yourself killed? No, I won't.
Peter drew back, his expression hurt and angry.
Fine, then, he said. Good luck finding the trunk, without me.
Not waiting for her response, he turned and crept closer to the clearing. As he reached its edge, he stopped and looked behind him. Molly was gone.
Fine, then.
On his stomach now, Peter inched forward until he could peer into the clearing. There were savages standing only a few feet in front of him. Beyond them he saw his mates. Alf stood with them. Although he'd heard talking as he crawled forward, there was only silence now, and a fearful look on Alf's face. Peter patted the ground around him. His hand closed on a rock, and he tugged it out of the damp, spongy soil. His plan now, it was the best he could come up with under the circumstances, was to create a distraction. He would hurl the rock at the savages, yell and then retreat into the jungle, hoping they'd chase after him. That would give Alf and the boys a chance to run off. Holding the rock, Peter rose to his feet.
Here goes nothing.
He took aim at the older savage who appeared to be the leader. He drew his arm back, judged the distance, then brought it forward hard. Nothing happened. His hand was empty.
Where's the rock?
Peter whirled, then gasped. Behind him, nearly on top of him, towered a large savage, holding Peter's rock up next to his face, smiling broadly. From the clearing, the older savage spoke.
Ah! I see fierce clamours found yet another visitor. Welcome, boy. Come join your friends. I was just about to explain our policy regarding strangers on this island.
Chapter 45. The Watchers. Blackstash and Smee struggled to the top of a steep ridge, breaking out from jungle to a thick green slippery moss, laid like a carpet over a black, gnarly volcanic rock. They were lost. They'd followed the tracks from the beach into the jungle and almost immediately became confused and frustrated by the suffocating vegetation. For the past hour they'd been thrashing around almost at random until finally Stash had decided to climb the ridge and get his bearings. He'd taken Smee, leaving the rest of their raiding party at the base of the mountain, with strict orders to keep alert, though Stash was sure they'd fallen asleep within minutes of his leaving them. Looking down at the menacing green carpet below, Stash held out his right hand, palm up. Smee studied it for a moment, then, concluding they were celebrating their successful climb, reached out his hand and shook Stash's.
"I don't want your bleeding hand, you idiot!"
bellowed Stash, startling a bright green bird into flight from its perch in the trees just below.
"I want the bleeding spyglass!"
Smee quickly tugged the brass spyglass from his waistband and handed it to Stash, who held it to his eye and began a slow, methodical sweep of the island below, left to right. About two-thirds of the way across, he stopped the glass.
"Aha!"
he said.
"Gesundheit!"
said Smee.
"No, you fool! Look there!"
Stash said, pointing.
"At the edge of that clearing. Do you see it?"
Smee peered downward, but saw nothing at the edge of the clearing. He didn't even see a clearing.
"It's a camp,"
said Stash, still looking through the glass.
"A camp! Savages!"
said Stash.
"Savages! The kind that...
"That eats people, yes,"
said Stash.
"Cannibals, by the look of them."
"So we'll be getting off this island now, Captain,"
said Smee.
"We'll be getting back on the ship and sailing, right?"
"No, Smee,"
said Stash, with a grim smile.
"No, but Captain, them's cannibals."
"They have the boys,"
said Stash.
"The boys from the Neverland, alive."
"No, chewed to the bone,"
Stash snarled, lunging at Smee, who jumped back.
"Of course they're alive. It's the same boys, including that cursed little devil who stole the trunk when it was in me grasp. And there's a sailor with them from the Neverland. He looks to be talking to an old savage with white hair."
"Talking to a savage?"
"I'm wondering about that myself,"
said Stash.
"I don't like this, Smee. I don't like it a bit. I'm wondering if the boys still have that trunk and are using the treasure, my treasure, Smee, to negotiate with them savages."
Stash handed the glass to Smee and stood for a moment, staring toward the clearing, thinking.
"Smee," he said. "Fetch the men."
With the telescope now held to his own eye, Smee said,
"But them cabanels have spears, Captain. Lots of spears, lots of cabanels, far as that goes."
"It's cannibals, idiot,"
said Stash.
"Now shut up and do as you're told. Them boys down there, mark my words, them boys is still mixed up with that trunk, with my trunk. And if them boys is working with the savages, I intend to find out about it. We're going down there, quiet-like, see what's what. Fetch the men, now."
As Smee, grumbling, started down the mountainside, Stash turned his gaze back toward the clearing and spoke softly to himself.
"And if it comes to cutting," he said, "they'll learn that spears is no match for pirate steel."
Chapter 46. Something in There. Peter, propelled by a shove from the big man behind him, stumbled into the clearing. The big man grunted something to Fighting Prawn, who nodded, then said to Peter,
"Fierce Clam thought he heard you whispering. Was there someone with you, boy?"
"No,"
Peter answered quickly. Then, frowning, he said,
"You speak English?"
Fighting Prawn sighed.
"I'm growing tired of having people point that out to me," he said. "Préférez-vous que je parle français?"
"What?"
said Peter.
"Never mind," said Fighting Prawn.
He grunt-clicked something, and Fierce Clam melted into the jungle, followed by two other mollusks.
"If there are others," said Fighting Prawn, "we'll find them."
Peter thought of Molly alone in the jungle, hunted.
Maybe I should have gone with her.
He shook his head, turning his attention to Alf and the boys, who looked tired and scared but relieved to see him.
"Are you all right, lad?" said Alf. "When you went overboard, we were so worried."
"I'm all right," said Peter. "How about you?"
Alf nodded toward the mollusks, gave a who-knows shrug.
"We're all right," said James.
"Oh, yes, we're fine," hissed Tubby Ted, "except for the part about being captured by savages."
"Savages?" said Fierce Clam.
He stepped toward the seated Tubby Ted.
"You think we're savages, boy?"
Tubby Ted, whimpering, scooted back a foot on his bottom.
"We're not savages here," continued Fighting Prawn. "I know. I've seen savagery. I saw it often when I was a guest of the British Navy. I experienced it many times myself, at the wrong end of a whip. Oh, yes, boy, I know what savagery is, and it's not to be found here, except when we have visitors."
"Sir," said Alf.
"If you please, we ain't savages neither. I'm just an old sea dog with no great love of the British Navy myself, and these here is just boys."
"Yes," said Fighting Prawn, "English boys, who will grow to be English men."
Alf started to answer, but Fighting Prawn turned away and began walking toward the mass of trees at the center of the clearing. The mollusks who'd been surrounding Alf and the boys stepped forward, tugged the seated boys to their feet, and began herding the group after Fighting Prawn. As they walked toward the trees, mollusks emerged from the labyrinth of vertical branches to watch their approach. By the time they reached the tree complex, the crowd had grown to at least 100 men, women, and children, staring at Alf and the others, who walked in a close, nervous little clot. Peter whispered to Alf,
"What do you think they're going to do to us?"
"We'll be fine, lad," whispered Alf,
though his eyes betrayed his misgivings.
"They're savages," said Tubby Ted. "They live in a tree. They mean to eat us. Look."
Coming into view ahead, just past the tree complex, smoke was rising lazily from a large fire pit. Prentice and Thomas clutched at Peter, whimpering.
"It's all right," said Peter,
putting his arms around the smaller boys, one on each side of him.
"Nobody's going to eat us,
I hope."
They were at the edge of the trees now. Peter tried to peer into the labyrinth of branch poles, but no matter which opening he looked in, he saw only a few feet before the passageway twisted out of sight into the gloomy interior. They moved along the edge of this strange street fortress until they came to a section where the exterior branch poles had been fortified with horizontal logs, lashed to the uprights with thick rope made from braided vines. These logs formed a wall easily 10 feet high and 40 feet wide. Peter could see that the wall curved inward at each end, continuing into the fortress.
"Like a cage," Peter thought.
Fighting Prawn stopped next to this wall, and the little procession stopped with him. Now the rest of the mollusks gathered around in a semicircle, staring at Alf and the children, who faced the tribe, their backs to the logs. Fighting Prawn began talking to the throng in mollusk, the tribe listening in motionless silence. His speech dragged on for 5 minutes, then 10. When he stopped, one of the other mollusk men spoke, then several of the women. Then Fighting Prawn spoke again at length, then some others. It seemed to be a debate of some kind, serious, but not heated. Peter noticed that the bright tropical light had faded slightly. Soon it would be dusk, then night would come to the jungle. He wondered how Molly was doing out there.
"I hope she's all right."
He realized that, aside from being scared, he was tired and hungry. It had been a long, foodless day. He leaned back, propping himself against the log wall. Suddenly he jerked forward. There was something moving behind him, inside the wall. He had not so much felt it as sensed it. He turned to see what it was, but there was very little space between the logs, and all he could see in the cracks between them was darkness. But there was something in there. Staring at the wall, Peter realized that the mollusks had stopped talking. He turned and saw that the tribe was again staring silently at the prisoners. Fighting Prawn stepped forward.
"Englishmen," he said, "we have made our decision. It was more difficult than usual because some of you are children, but we have a law for visitors.
We have learnt that this law is the only way we can ensure the survival of the Mollusk people. We have made exceptions in the past, and we always regretted it. We have since decided that there can be no exceptions, even for children. The law must be applied to you as well. I am sorry.
Fighting Prawn, Grunt clicked something. A dozen adult male mollusks began moving forward. The boys shrank against the log wall, huddling behind Alf.
"What do you mean?" pleaded Alf. "What law? What are you going to do to us?"
Fighting Prawn didn't answer. The men kept coming forward. Behind them, a column of smoke from the fire pit drifted diagonally into the bright blue sky. James, Prentice, and Thomas were clinging to Peter, who found he could not breathe.
"No!" screamed Tubby Ted. "Don't eat me, please!"
That brought a grim smile to Fighting Prawn's face.
"Eat you?" he said. "We're not going to eat you."
Peter exhaled, then froze as Fighting Prawn spoke again.
"We're going to feed you to Mr. Grin."
Chapter 47 A Magic Island. Slank and Little Richard, having hidden their dory in the pirate's longboat, set off along the beach. Slank was in the lead. Little Richard walked a few paces back, armed with a flintlock pistol, which he hoped would be effective against spiders.
"But," he asked, "where are we going?"
"Around that point, there," said Slank, gesturing ahead toward a rocky spit of land.
"So we ain't going into the jungle?" asked Little Richard, hopefully.
"Not right here," said Slank. "This is where Mr. Stash went in, and I don't want us to run into him quite yet. Not till we find what we're looking for. We'll go around that point, then we'll move inland."
"Oh," said Little Richard unhappily.
Walking on the hard-packed sand at the water's edge, they quickly reached the rocky point, a jumble of lava boulders. They worked their way through these until Slank, in the lead, peered over the top of a massive weathered rock and beheld a spectacular lagoon, its deep blue water shimmering and sparkling like diamonds in the late afternoon sun. In the center of the lagoon's curve, a waterfall burst from one of two hillside caves and splashed down onto a cluster of gigantic boulders. Some yards offshore from these was a smaller group of smooth black rocks, like a miniature island. The nearest of the rocks rose to a flat spot, like the seat of a chair. Somebody, or something, was sitting in the chair. Slank blinked and strained to see it more clearly.
"It can't be," he muttered.
"What is it, Mr. Slank?" said Little Richard.
"It's a woman," said Slank. "But it's got a woman."
Little Richard, who liked women as much as he hated spiders, scrambled forward, inadvertently knocking Slank aside as he hauled himself up on the rock to see.
"Sir," he said, "I don't see no woman."
Slank stuck his head back up. The rock was empty.
"She was there," he said, pointing. "She was right there."
Little Richard eyed Slank doubtfully.
"I tell you, I saw her," said Slank. "She had golden hair and a..."
"A what, Mr. Slank?"
"A tail," Slank said. "Instead of legs, she had a long green tail."
"A tail?" said Little Richard. "This woman that isn't there now had a tail?"
"Yes,"
said Slank.
"So what you're saying, sir," said Little Richard, "is you saw a mermaid?"
"I didn't say that," said Slank. "I said I saw a woman with a...
"A tail," said Little Richard.
"Yes, a tail," said Slank.
Well, now he was starting to wonder himself.
"All right, then," said Little Richard gently. "Maybe what you need, sir, is a little rest."
"I saw her," said Slank.
"Course you did, sir," said Little Richard. "Course you did. Now what you need is a nice sit down in the shade there, and then..."
"Look!"
exclaimed Slank, gripping the big man's forearm. Little Richard looked, and there, on the rock, dripping seawater, were two mermaids. One with golden hair, one with black hair. Both breathtakingly beautiful. Little Richard tried to speak, but his throat clogged and his face turned red. Finally, he spat it out.
"True?"
"I told you," said Slank.
"What kind of island is this?"
said Little Richard, gazing wide-eyed at the mermaids.
"It's magical, it is."
"Yes,"
said Slank, more to himself than to Little Richard.
"There's magic here, all right."
His hand went under his shirt and for a moment curled around a gold locket he wore there. Then he ducked behind the rock, grabbing Little Richard's massive shoulder and pulling down on it.
"Get down,"
he hissed. Reluctantly, Little Richard tore his eyes from the fish women and crouched next to Slank.
"But they're so beautiful, sir,"
he said.
"You'll have a better view soon,"
said Slank.
"We're going over there."
"We are,"
said Little Richard, overjoyed.
"We are,"
said Slank.
"But quietly, we're not going to let them see us until we get nice and close so they can't swim off. Them creatures has what we're after, and I aim to get it from them."
"But we ain't gonna hurt them, sir."
"Only if we have to,"
said Slank.
"Only if they try to keep it."
Chapter 48 The Law. For a moment neither Alf nor the boys could speak. They stared at Fighting Prawn, faces frozen in dread. Peter broke the silence.
"Please, sir,"
he said, "who is Mr. Grin?" As he spoke, he again sensed something move inside the log structure. The earth beneath him seemed to shake. Something in there, something very big.
"Mr. Grin," said Fighting Prawn, "is a native of Mollusk Island. For many years he was a peaceful neighbor to the Mollusk people. He went his way, we went ours. But then some years ago, visitors came to our island, sailors, Englishmen. They were like you. They thought it would be good sport to hunt Mr. Grin."
Something thrashed inside the enclosure. The walls shook. The boys cowered, scurrying back on their bottoms. Even Alf retreated a few feet.
"We urged these men not to harm our old neighbor, but of course they did not listen to us. We are savages, don't forget. The English are civilized."
Fighting Prawn smiled, not pleasantly.
"They were good hunters, these Englishmen," he said. "They captured Mr. Grin, managed to snare him with grappling hooks, then drag him up the beach and tie him to a tree with ropes. Then they had their sport. They drank their rum and teased him, prodded and poked to see what he would do, used him for their amusement. We asked them to stop, but Englishmen do not care what savages think. Finally, a young mollusk boy, who could no longer bear to hear Mr. Grin's roars of pain, that night, when the drunken Englishman had fallen asleep, the boy crept among them and tried to cut Mr. Grin free. An Englishman awoke and saw the boy. He shot him in the leg. The boy fell, screaming. Some of our people saw what happened. The boy lay on the ground, bleeding, screaming, and the Englishman did nothing. Mr. Grin was only a few feet away. Mr. Grin was so angry by then."
Fighting Prawn looked at the ground, then at the enclosure, then back to Peter.
"That boy was my son," he said.
"But, sir," said Peter, "that wasn't..."
"We attacked the Englishmen then," said Fighting Prawn, ignoring Peter. "They were surprised that we would do that, and even more surprised when we defeated them. In the end, they cried like babies, begged us for mercy. We told them they would have to ask Mr. Grin for mercy. He showed them none."
Another movement from inside the logs.
"We released Mr. Grin then, because it was not his fault, none of it. But they'd ruined him, you see, given him a taste for humans. Instead of returning to the jungle, he stayed near our village, watching us, smelling us, wanting us, lurking, waiting. We had no choice but to capture and kill him."
"But he's still alive," Peter said.
"Yes," said Fighting Prawn. "As fate would have it, another ship arrived on the day we were to do it. So instead of destroying Mr. Grin, we put him to work. Now it is our law to keep the island ours. For mollusks, not for outsiders."
"But, sir," said Peter, "those were pirates. We're on this island because pirates attacked us also. We feel the same way about them as you do."
"The lad is right,"
Alf was speaking now.
"We mean you no harm."
"Yes, you would say that," said Fighting Prawn. "You visitors always say that, and sometimes you may even mean it. But
We have learnt that you visitors are always trouble, pirates or no. You have abused our hospitality, brought disease, taken us as slaves, killed us like animals.
But that wasn't us, exclaimed Peter. We didn't do those things.
You haven't yet, said Fighting Prawn, and Mr. Grin will see to it that you never will. That is our law.
He turned and grunted something. Instantly, two men appeared with a ladder of lash bamboo. They leaned it against the log wall. From within there came a low growl. Tubby Ted whimpered. Prentice and Thomas clutched each other, sobbing. James gripped Peter's arm.
But, sir, it was Alf speaking now, you can't mean to. I mean, these are just boys.
No exceptions, said Fighting Prawn. It's the law. He grunted something.
Four men with spears approached Alf.
Wait, there's a trunk, said Peter, exchanging a quick glance with Alf. It has powers. It's magic. And we think it's on this island. We could help you find it, sir. Show you how to use the power.
Fighting Prawn shook his head in disgust.
Lying now, he said. They all try that too. Lying to the savages as though we're children, easily tricked. Here's your magic.
He spat on the ground.
But the magic is real, Alf said. I've seen it with me own eyes. What the boy says is true.
Fighting Prawn looked back and forth between Alf and Peter, and for a moment Peter thought Alf might have convinced him. But then the old man grunted again to the four men, who prodded Alf roughly toward the ladder, forcing him to climb.
No, said Alf, pointing to the logs. I ain't going in there.
Then these men will spear you and throw your body over the wall, said Fighting Prawn. Either way, you will go in there.
As he spoke, one of the men pressed a spear point against Alf's chest. Alf winced as he felt the razor-sharp shell penetrate his shirt and prick his chest.
All right, Alf said. I'll go without a fight, but only if it's just me. Please, not the boys. They're just boys.
Boys, yes, said Fighting Prawn. Just like my son.
Prodded from below, his legs now pricked and bleeding, Alf climbed to the top of the wall. He looked over the side, then back at Peter, his face white as a sail.
Alf,
said Peter. Alf started to speak, but before he could, he was shoved over the wall and was gone. The boys were next, one by one, first Tubby Ted, then James, Prentice, and Thomas, all sobbing, were driven at spear point up the ladder and over the wall. Peter was last. He climbed without prodding. At the top, he looked back, down at Fighting Prawn, and said, "This is wrong. We've done nothing."
"Yes, you have," said Fighting Prawn. "You came to this island."
He paused, then added, "You're a brave boy." He looked once to Sky and then back to Peter.
"Perhaps Mr. Grin will have mercy upon you."
Then he motioned to his men, but before they could act, Peter jumped over the wall to join his mates. And Mr. Grin. Chapter 49 Into the Cave.
"Quiet!"
Slank hissed. Slank and Little Richard struggled, sweating through the darkening but still hot jungle, staying out of sight as they followed the sweeping curve of the lagoon toward the dark mouth of the cave. From time to time they peered carefully through the vegetation at the two green-tailed she-fish. Each time Little Richard stared, almost hypnotized by the creatures. The closer he got, the more beautiful they looked to him. In 20 minutes they had crept behind the trees to a spot directly up the beach from the rocks where the she-fish sprawled, unmoving, facing out to sea, apparently oblivious to the approach of the two men.
"All right," whispered Slank. "We want to get as close as we can, but not scare them, understand?"
"Yes,"
said Little Richard, excited at the prospect of getting close, especially to the blonde one.
"All right, then," said Slank. "Here goes."
He stepped out from the trees, followed by Little Richard. The two men walked down the beach until the gentle lagoon surf lapped at their boots. They were now perhaps 25 feet from the rock where the she-fish lay.
"Hello there, ladies," said Slank cordially.
The she-fish spun, their bodies now rigid. They stared at the two men with expressionless faces dominated by round, huge sea-blue eyes.
"Beautiful eyes," thought Little Richard.
but not human eyes.
My name is Slank, said Slank. I think you might have run into something I am looking for.
The sheepfish did not speak or move. For 20 seconds there was no sound but the low hiss of the surf.
We mean you no harm, said Slank.
As reassurance, Little Richard parted his lips in a broad smile. He had 9.5 teeth in all, the colour of tree bark. The instant he opened his mouth, the already wide eyes of the sheepfish became even wider. Before Slank could say another word, the creatures had flipped their tails, slithered off the rock, and slid into the lagoon.
Wait!
Shouted Slank, but they were gone. The men's eyes followed the long, graceful shapes, gliding underwater with astonishing speed, to a dark opening in the jumble of ship-sized rocks nearby. The sheepfish surfaced there, looked back for a moment at the men, then dove again, their bodies shooting into a dark opening between two massive boulders and disappearing.
You idiot!
Said Slank, turning and throwing a punch that landed on Little Richard's massive trunk, having no effect other than to hurt Slank's fist.
What did you do?
Nothing, I swear, said Little Richard. I just smiled at him, is all.
Well, don't do it again, said Slank. You scared them, and now we've got to go in there after them.
He gestured at the dark opening in the rocks.
We do,
said Little Richard, who, in addition to spiders, did not care for the dark.
We do,
said Slank, wading into the lagoon toward the big rocks, with Little Richard reluctantly following. As the water reached his waist, Slank pulled the two pistols from his belt, holding them up to keep them dry. When they reached the cave opening, the water was up to Slank's chest and Little Richard's waist. The two men paused and looked into the cave. In the late dusk, they could see only a short distance. On either side, water sloshed against smaller rocks. Overhead was a high, sloping, cathedral-like ceiling, formed by massive rocks leaning together. Ahead lay a yawning darkness.
I don't like this, said Little Richard.
I've seen you whip 6 men at once in a fight, said Slank. How can you be afraid of women?
Those ain't normal women, said Little Richard. And it's dark.
Just the same, said Slank, holding his pistols high as he waded into the gloom. We're going in.
They moved forward, the sound of their sloshing echoing back to them in the dark, cavernous space. Soon they were in deep gloom, barely able to make out the cave walls, no longer able to see beneath the surface of the water.
Hey!
Shouted Little Richard, his voice booming off the walls. Slank spun, pistols levelled.
What?
He shouted.
I felt something, said Little Richard. It touched me leg.
It's your mind playing tricks, said Slank. Stop being such a baby.
But it was bothering him now, the darkness of the water. They pressed on, the cave entrance now almost out of sight, their eyes straining to pick up what little of the wan dusk filtered in through openings in the boulders high overhead.
What was that?
Now it was Slank's turn to think something had touched him. He kicked out his right leg but struck nothing, and now he saw it. Something was roiling the water around them. Little Richard saw it too.
They're big,
said the big man moving close.
Stand back to back, said Slank. Get your sword ready.
They moved together, each facing out. The roiling around them was getting more pronounced now. There was a splash and the tip of a tail, and then several more from different directions.
There's more than two,
thought Slank. And then a woman's head appeared, streaming hair, circling a few yards away. Then another head, and another.
A lot more than two. What are they doing?
Said Little Richard behind Slank.
What do they want?
I don't know,
said Slank, trying to shake the thought.
They led us in here. It's a trap.
Now, in the gloom, they could make out 6, perhaps 7 heads circling them, moving very fast, still a few yards away. But Slank saw now that the circle they spun was shrinking. Inch by inch, the she-fish were drawing closer, closer. And then they stopped. One of them, the men could see now, it was the blonde one that they had seen before, was directly in front of Little Richard, just out of his reach. Not that he wanted to touch her. She looked into his face. Her face without expression, blue eyes seeming to glow. Then she smiled. Little Richard gasped. The she-thing's mouth was a horror, the top overcrowded with a jumble of jagged teeth, more shark than human,
The bottom row was a hard, smooth, bony plate, still more fish than human. Little Richard raised his right arm and, with it, his sword. He meant the gesture purely defensively, but the instant he moved, another she-fish, Slank's glimpse told him it was the black-haired one that had been outside, hissed and darted forward snake-like, opening her own hideous mouth and clamping her needle-sharp teeth down on his right forearm. Slank whirled to shoot it, but Little Richard, bellowing in pain, moved faster. He brought his massive left fist down on the she-fish's head. She emitted a blood-chilling screech and fell away into the dark water. The cave filled with hisses now as the other she-fish erupted in a frenzy of furious motion. Little Richard screamed in pain as another set of teeth sunk into the back of his left thigh. He reached down frantically, trying to knock the thing away. The water around the two men foamed and boiled. Slank swept his pistols back and forth, but could find nothing to aim at. The she-fish were moving too fast, and mostly underwater. And then they were gone. For a moment there was no sound in the cave, but Slank's breathing and Little Richard's moans as he felt the pain of his wounds, especially the jagged hole in his leg. Then they surfaced, perhaps 20 feet away, 5, no, 6 of them. One of them, the one Little Richard had struck, was clearly hurt, possibly unconscious. The other 5 were supporting it, making odd, low noises. They were moving away slowly toward a bend in the cave wall. As they rounded it, Slank could see them looking back toward the men, could see the fury in their glowing blue eyes, could see... Wait a minute. There was something odd. Why can I see them so clearly? Slank squinted for a moment and then realized what it was. There was light coming from somewhere around the bend, from deeper in the cave. Something in there was giving off light. Come on, he told Little Richard, moving toward where the she-fish had disappeared around the curve.
What? Said Little Richard, grimacing in pain. Do you want to follow those devil things?
Yes, said Slank, pushing forward, excited now.
Little Richard, not wanting to go, but afraid of being alone in the dark water, followed. They reached the bend in the cave wall, and Slank, holding his pistols in front of him, inched forward until he could see around it.
Well, well, he said softly.
Little Richard leaned around to see, and gasped. In front of them was a little cove, at the back of which was a rock ledge, perhaps 30 feet across. Lying on the ledge to the right was the injured she-fish, still being attended to by the 5 who had carried it there. Arrayed along the ledge in the water in front of it were many more, Slank estimated 2 dozen she-fish. Behind them on a pile of rocks at the center of the ledge was the source of the glow that filled the cavern. The trunk. It was battered and lopsided, light streaming from its many cracks.
It's mine, said Slank, mostly to himself.
The creatures, keeping their glowing blue eyes fixed on the men, moved slowly toward the center of the cove, gathering in front of the trunk.
I don't think they mean to give it up, said Little Richard. They're protecting it. Yes, they'd want to keep it, said Slank, but I don't mean to let them.
He turned to Little Richard.
Go get it, he said. Me? Said Little Richard. But go get it,
barked Slank, evoking a flurry of hisses from the she-fish.
If they come at you, Slank continued in a calmer voice, I'll shoot them.
Still, Little Richard hesitated.
If you don't go in there, said Slank, I'll shoot you.
Little Richard stared at him for a moment and saw he meant it. Turning back, he took a breath and began wading toward the she-fish. The creatures began darting nervously side to side. The hissing increased. Little Richard glanced back over his shoulder, pleadingly towards Slank, but found himself looking down the barrel of a pistol. He turned away and took another step toward the creatures, who were very agitated now, opening their mouths as they hissed, revealing those terrifying teeth. It happened in less than a second. One of the she-fish shot from the pack, mouth agape, straight for Little Richard. As he threw his hands up, the cave rang with sudden sound of a pistol shot, magnified by the stone walls. Incredibly, for the creature was moving very fast, Slank's aim was true. The pistol ball struck it in the neck, and it fell back with a gurgling sound, blood spurting from the wound. The cave now filled with unearthly shrieks and screeches. Another creature, and now a third, lunged at Little Richard, and Slank fired again. This time he missed, but the sound of another shot and its ricochet off the stone was apparently too terrifying for the she-fish. As suddenly as they had attacked, they whirled and retreated. Grabbing their two wounded, the creatures flashed their powerful tails and dove, giving the men and their terrible weapon a wide berth, swarming from the cove and toward the cave entrance. Slank, still holding his pistols leveled, watched them go. Little Richard, barely believing he'd been spared, slowly lowered his hands from in front of his face, took a deep breath, and exhaled.
"That was worse than spiders," he said.
"It's a good thing," said Slank. "They don't know, but there's but one shot per pistol."
Then he turned slowly, savoring the moment, toward the glowing, now unguarded trunk.
"And now," he said, "you're mine."
Chapter 50 Eyes in the Dark. Peter stumbled down a steep slope of hard-packed dirt that formed the interior wall of the mollusk's log structure. He couldn't see where he was going, as the dense tree branches overhead blocked out most of the fading dusk light. After a few feet, the wall became even steeper, almost vertical, and Peter lost his footing, falling.
Ooh!
Peter had slammed into a body sprawled on the earthen floor.
"Sorry," he said.
"Get off me,"
hissed Tubby Ted.
"Where are the others?"
said Peter, scrambling to his feet.
"Here, lad,"
said Alf, his deep voice reassuring to Peter.
"Over here."
As his eyes adjusted to the darkness, he saw Alf's big bulk with the three smaller forms of James, Thomas, and Prentice huddled next to him. They were in a corner of the space, but he couldn't see how large it was, only two walls disappearing off into the gloom. He took a step toward Alf, and his foot hit something hard and hollow-sounding. It skittered forward a few feet. James bent and picked it up, then dropped it, screaming. It was a skull.
"It's all right, lad," said Alf, hugging the sobbing boy. "It's all right."
"No, it's not," said Prentice.
He was pointing at something, a pile of things. Peter peered at it. Bones. He looked around and realized that the floor was covered with them. Bones and skulls. Dozens of skulls. Then they heard it. From somewhere off in the darkness. Another growl.
"We have to get out of here,"
whispered Peter. He turned back and tried to scale the wall, but it was too steep to climb, and he couldn't gain either a handhold or a foothold on its smooth, hard-packed surface.
"Here, lad,"
said Alf, heaving Peter up onto his shoulders, but as high as Peter could reach, the wall was hard and smooth and steep.
"It's no use,"
he said, and Alf set him back on the floor. Another growl, this one closer. The boys backed away from the sound into the corner, Alf and Peter in front of them, all of them peering into the darkness, watching, listening. Another growl, still louder, and a scraping sound like claws, and the rumble of a massive weight shifting and dragging on the hard earth floor, coming ever closer. James screamed again, and as he did, they all saw what he saw in the distance, in the darkness, coming toward them. Two ovals, red, glowing like coals, each with a cruel black vertical slit.
"Those are eyes," thought Peter. "But they're impossibly far apart."
Another growl. The glowing eyes moved. Chapter 51 Bird. Fighting Prawn and the rest of the mollusks stood outside the cage, silent, waiting. Waiting for the screaming to start, dreading it, knowing that once the screaming started, it would be much longer, hours sometimes, before it finally stopped. The mollusks took no pleasure in enforcing the law, but Fighting Prawn was their leader, the only one who had lived with the outsiders, and he had told them that this, difficult as it was, especially with children, was the only way they could protect themselves and their island. And so they waited, as the evening sky darkened into night. Fighting Prawn, as always, stood closest to the cage, staring at it, absolutely still. The others gathered around him in a loose semicircle, all of them facing the logs, imagining what was happening inside, waiting, waiting. It was because they were facing the logs
that they did not immediately notice the movement high in the trees just outside of the clearing. It was a small child, a girl of 3, who saw it first. She cried out to her mother, her tiny voice making the grunt click sounds for bird.
"Bird! Bird!"
she said.
"Hush!"
her mother said.
"Bird!"
the girl repeated.
"Big! There!"
And then her mother looked up and saw it, and her shout of surprise and alarm caused the rest of the mollusks to look up too, shouting as the thing swooped through the high branches at the edge of the clearing, coming closer now, clearly far larger than any bird they'd ever seen, its shape difficult to discern in the near darkness. The entire tribe was shouting and pointing now. Suddenly the thing burst from the trees into the clearing, swooping low toward the mollusks. Some screamed, others ducked. Still others ran. A few men hurled spears toward the thing, but it was moving too fast, and in an instant it was over the wall, into the cage, out of sight. Fighting Prawn, standing calmly amid the chaos of his people, watched the swooping thing pass overhead. For an instant, as it disappeared, he thought that it looked like... But that's impossible. And then his mind went to something the boy had said.
"It's magic. And we think it's on this island."
Chapter 52. Mr. Grin. The glowing eyes were coming.
"Get behind me, lads," shouted Alf, crouching, preparing to fight. But what?
He wasn't sure. Peter, ignoring Alf, dropped to hands and knees, looking in the gloom for a weapon. He grabbed a heavy bone. "Must be a leg," he thought, then found its mate, which he handed to Alf. The thing was coming fast now. The cage echoed with the sound of claws scrabbling on the floor and massive weight being dragged closer, closer. Now Peter could see the massive flat head, and now the glowing eyes disappeared from view as the thing opened the biggest mouth Peter had ever seen, lying top and bottom with jagged teeth as big as daggers, a gaping cavern of a mouth that easily could have taken him in whole. The cage echoed with a monstrous, bone-chilling roar. Then the enormous mouth snapped shut with a sound like a gunshot, and the thing sprang forward at its prey.
"No!"
bellowed Alf, leaping forward to meet it, swinging the leg bone down hard with both hands onto the massive charging snout, and right in time. The bone broke in two, the creature stopped for a moment as if surprised, then it snapped again and lunged at Alf, who sidestepped, trying to draw it away from the boys. His ploy worked. The thing turned toward him, pivoting its huge body, sending its massive tail, a tail Peter now saw that was the size of a longboat, sweeping across the wall, sending Peter and the other boys flying.
"Come on, you devil!" Alf was shouting. "Come on and fight like a man!"
He was walking backward, trying to keep his eye on the monster as he looked around desperately for another weapon. Peter lunged to his feet and followed, careful to keep out of the way of that terrible tail, his plan being to toss the other leg bone to Alf. As the tail swept back and forth, Peter jumped over it, as though it were a jump rope.
"Alf!" he yelled. "Stand back, boy!" shouted Alf. "Stand... Oh!"
Alf was down. He tripped on a skull and he'd hit his head hard. He moaned and rolled sideways, but did not get up. The monster opened its mouth again. It would be eating Alf in another step.
"No!"
screamed Peter, leaping forward again, dodging the sweeping tail, and bringing his bone club smashing down on the thing's hard, scaly back.
"No! No! No!"
he shouted, each time striking it again. The monster whirled and snapped, moving far faster than Peter expected. Peter jerked his hands back just far enough, but the bone was caught, instantly crunched to splinters in the monster's massive jaws. Now it was Peter's turn to scramble backward, with the thing turning in his direction, coming after him, coming, coming, its glowing eyes strangely dispassionate, a hungry beast about to do its work. As Peter backed away, he simultaneously crouched and felt around his feet for another bone, for anything. He touched nothing but hard ground. He backed up some more, hit something hard, the wall. He was trapped in the corner. The monster paused as if knowing Peter had no way out. It halted, and then slowly opened its massive mouth, close enough now that Peter could smell its musty, fetid breath. He could have reached out and touched the dagger teeth that were about to tear into his flesh. Peter closed his eyes and held out his hands in a futile gesture of self-protection. And, as he did,
"Peter!"
shouted a voice.
Molly! He opened his eyes and saw her hovering above him, waving something. Here! She shouted, dropping it. He caught it. The locket. He fumbled frantically at it but could not find a catch.
It won't open!
He shouted. The beast moved closer, its jaws wide open.
There's a button on the side!
Shouted Molly.
Closer.
Hands shaking, Peter found the button and the locket sprang open. Instantly, his hands disappeared inside the glowing sphere.
Touch the inside part,
shouted Molly. Peter put his finger into the heart of the sphere and immediately he felt his body start to rise, felt his feet leave the floor.
Too late.
He saw it in an instant. The jaws were closing and they would catch him.
Too late.
Instinctively, Peter struck out at the closing jaws. His right hand, with the locket still in it, landed directly on the tip of the monster's snout, which was suffused by the sphere. The jaws stopped, half open, half closed. The monster made a noise, not a roar this time, more of a groan, of even a sigh. And then, slowly, slowly, the monster began to rise from the floor of the cage, its body perfectly still, and in the light from the locket, Peter, who was also rising slowly, could finally see its true size. It had to be 25 feet long, he thought.
Maybe 30 feet. It must weigh a ton.
But it rose like a feather, the monster did. Rose as easy as a bit of ash carried by a wisp of smoke.
Up, up,
and then over the thick log wall. And then, with a flick of its tail, it drifted, still sighing, off into the jungle night.
Chapter 53 The Power. Black Stash, with Smee and the rest of his raiding party crouched behind him, peered through the dense jungle into the camp of the savages. It looked to Stash as if the whole lot of them were praying to a giant wall made of wood and mud. They stood silently facing it, man, woman, and child. Stash was intensely interested in what was on the other side of that wall, for only moments earlier he'd seen the boy, that boy, the cause of so much of Stash's troubles, climb a bamboo ladder, say something to the white-haired old savage below, and then disappear over the wall.
Where that boy is, the trunk is nearby.
Stash was sure of it. He was eager to lead his men over that wall, but unsure of the disposition of the savages, and so he waited and watched and listened.
No!
The shout from a grown man came from the other side of the wall. The man sounded terrified. His shout was followed by a loud, unnatural snapping sound like, could that be a bone? Stash wondered what could snap a bone like that. Just then a little girl, savage, turned his way, pointed and started shouting. Stash ducked, thinking at first that she'd spotted him, but then he heard a rustle in the branches above. He looked up and gasped.
A flying girl.
Directly over them, swooping like a bird.
The same girl that had been on that ship.
He was sure of it.
Sir,
whispered Smee, pointing.
There's a...
I see her, idiot,
hissed Stash, clapping his hand over Smee's mouth. The girl swooped swiftly across the clearing and, as the native shouted and pointed in alarm, disappeared over the wall. Stash was worried now. All this flying, he was now certain, had something to do with the treasure he was after. The flying boy had gone over the wall, and now this flying girl. He decided that, savages or no, it was time to find out what was on the other side of that wall. He signaled to his men. They rose, drawing swords and pistols. Facing the clearing, Stash held his hand up, about to give the signal to attack. Then his arm dropped, limp, staring in astonishment. His men followed his gaze. Several shouted in alarm, but there was no danger of their being heard by the savages who were now in loud disarray themselves, many shouting and running frantically to get away from the gigantic creature now emerging from behind the wall.
A crocodile,
Stash thought, as the thing floated fully into view.
A flying crocodile.
Stash had seen crocodiles before. He'd seen dozens, but never one this large. Never one half the size of this monster. He stood motionless as the croc drifted his way 30 feet in the air,
its tail swishing back and forth lazily, its legs moving as though it were swimming. It passed almost directly overhead, then continued off over the jungle treetops. Stash watched it disappear, then looked at his men, who were looking back at him with expressions ranging from concern to outright terror.
"All right, men," he said. "It's a crocodile. You've seen crocodiles before."